All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Our next guest is Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan. And his blog, of course, is juancole.com, informed comment. And I just had it in my head, but the name of his most recent book slipped my mind, so now I'm going to click the link. I'm sorry, Juan. Welcome back to the show. I had it right in front of me a second ago.
Quite right. It's engaging the Muslim world.
Right, engaging. Why did I get stuck on engaging? It was lost there. All right, engaging the Muslim world.
The same thing happens to Washington.
Right, yeah. Well, I don't think they ever even heard of it. Engage it. Why engage it when you can blow it up? Seems to be their philosophy over there. And also, they like to lie about things. That's part of their philosophy, too. And so that was the piece I was looking at here a second ago on your blog was the top 10 myths about Afghanistan in 2010. And I was wondering if we could just talk about some of these here, or the most important ones, maybe all 10. I don't know.
Sure, absolutely.
All right, so what's the most important thing for people to understand? I mean, hell, I saw a thing in the Times said 25% of the American people even follow the Afghan war, so they might not even know they're being lied to about anything because they never even heard the lies. They're paying no attention whatsoever. But for the 25% of people who've been paying attention whatsoever, what's not true that they've been made to believe is?
Well, I mean, for one thing, we keep hearing from the Pentagon about all this progress that's being made as a result of the troop escalation. And in a guerrilla war, measuring progress is awfully difficult because things are subterranean. And sure, you know, you put conventional military troops in an area, and the guerrillas will fade away. But that doesn't mean they're gone. So the CIA did a national, well, the 16 intelligence agencies did a national intelligence estimate, which just was, you know, parts of it were leaked recently. And they don't see progress. In fact, they see large swathes of Afghanistan as being in danger of being taken over by the Taliban. So what the intelligence agencies are seeing and what the Pentagon says it's seeing are not the same.
Well, now, you know, I heard numbers about, say, last summer about, well, the Taliban control this or that much percent of the country. Sometimes they would say, well, at night, it's more things like that. Can you give me an actual estimate of what that looks like? And what exactly does that mean, Taliban control? I mean, they don't outright rule cities, right? Or do they?
Well, apparently they do rule some rural areas. There are, you know, the equivalent of counties that are more or less under Taliban control. I mean, actually being governed by them.
And then I guess does that also imply that there's no pretended central government there to compete with them?
Well, Scott, there's no pretended central government in most of the country. The best estimates are that the Karzai government in Kabul may assert its authority over as much as 30% of the country. Mm-hmm. The only question is the other 70% run by warlords who more or less, you know, get along with Kabul? Or are they ruled by Taliban who hate the Karzai government?
Right.
And, you know, the estimates are all over the map, but something on the order of 10 to 15%, some people would say as much as 20% of the country, is under the control of insurgent groups. They're not all actually Taliban. Some of them are old Mujahideen that we called freedom fighters who've now turned on the U.S. occupation of the country. But
such as Haqqani.
It's something like 15, 20%, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Are you referring to Haqqani there, or
more
examples?
There are more. Haqqani, Jalaluddin Haqqani, you know, was feted by Ronald Reagan as a freedom fighter, one of the Mujahideen. And his Haqqani network is one of the more deadly of the insurgent groups. And then Gulbuddin Hikmatyar and his Islamic party, or Hizb-e Islami.
Isn't he the guy that they hired, that they outsourced the Tora Bora assault to, turned around and let bin Laden go?
No, that wasn't. That was one of the other Mujahideen. That wasn't Hikmat. Hikmat Yar didn't agree with the U.S. coming in the first place.
Well, I know that there was a quote somewhere where he was bragging and saying, yeah, I took the CIA's money and then I helped bin Laden escape.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, Scott, but it's certainly the case that Hikmat Yar talks dirty about bin Laden. He thinks that bin Laden kind of ruined the whole gig. But, you know, back in the 80s when the U.S. was giving billions to the Mujahideen, Hikmet Yar was their golden boy, and he got 20% of all the money that came in. So he's now running an insurgent group. And there are other smaller Mujahideen groups operating. The U.S. press and the Pentagon, White House, tend to just call them all Taliban, but they're not. The old Taliban of Mullah Omar are just one of these groups. And it's kind of embarrassing, I think, for the Americans that they're probably mostly fighting their former allies.
Yeah, well, isn't that always the way? all right, well, so, geez, I kind of want to dwell on that some more, but I just wanted to mention that, I guess 2 days ago I looked at iCasualties, and it was 495 Americans have died, American soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan this year. I think you write here on your blog, 701, if you include all of NATO there. And then I wanted to kind of move on to number 9, because this is such an important point. Afghans want the U.S. and NATO troops to stay in their country because they feel protected by them.
Yeah, it's not clear that, I mean, it's clear that they don't, in fact, feel protected by them. Only a minority says that they feel that the U.S. or NATO can give them protection. And then there are a couple of polls out. One of them says 64% of Afghans want the U.S. to stay. Another one says 55% of them want them to go. You know, polling in a country like Afghanistan is not easy. But it seems to be like nowadays something close to a 50-50 split on whether they want the foreigners out. And this is a big change. I mean, the important thing is you go back to 2004, all these numbers look very different. They were very positive about the U.S. and NATO. They thought they could protect them. They supported them. And now there's obviously very substantial discontent with this presence of foreign troops.
You know what? Forget the list for just a second. Is there any way out of this? I mean, if you were on the National Security Council, do you have any advice for them other than pack up your things and your C-130s and get the hell out of there?
Well, you know, the plan that they have, Scott, is the same plan that all decolonizing states have. That's what we're doing, right? We're decolonizing in Afghanistan. We went in there, NATO occupied the place, and now we want to get out. And the European countries are all announcing 2014. Joe Biden's announcing 2014. They're all saying that that's the end game. We are getting out. It's just it's over the next 5 years. And in the meantime, what do? Is you train up the new Afghan army like crazy. You train the police. You try to have somebody to turn the thing over to. You do as much development work as you can so the place isn't as much of an economic basket case. And that's all they can do. You know, there's no precision science in the decolonization. Sometimes it goes well. You know, the British handed off Kenya to Kenyatta, and at least until recently that seemed to go all right. On the other hand, you know, India and Pakistan had that horrible partition in which 700,000 people were probably killed. Algeria fought a vicious war against the French that finally got them out, but probably cost 500,000 lives at least. So, you know, you can't tell how the decolonization will go, but the elements of it are always the same. As you try to stand up a government, stand up a bureaucracy, stand up an army that's local and can take on things, you try to get the neighbors to be cooperative, and then you get out.
Yeah. All right, well, I wonder about the so-called insurgent math of General McChrystal, because, you know, I'm pretty hyperbolic a lot of times, Juan, you know that. And I can sit here and say, just as simple as pie, that, look, the more you escalate, the more people hate it. You went in with the Rumsfeld light and fast maneuver, and now you're here forever and bogged down, and you just make it worse and make more enemies. But is it more complex than that, or is it as simple as that?
Well, I mean, the problem for the NATO and the U.S. has been that initially the Afghans were pretty happy to see the back of the Taliban, and that was pretty much across the board. I mean, opinion polling in the early zeros suggested maybe 5% of Afghans liked the Taliban. So that's low. That's high negatives. However, over the past few years, is from about 2005 forward, The insurgency groups have grown in power, and you've seen this remarkable development in northwest Pakistan of Pakistani Taliban, which never even existed before about 2000, who are giving aid and support to the Afghan insurgents. So insurgency has grown, and it's taken territory. It's challenged NATO. It's challenged the Karzai government. And, you know, militaries push back against that kind of thing. And as you say, there is always the danger that if you escalate and you become more what the military calls kinetic, you do more wide-ranging military operations, you take over villages, you do search and destroy missions, you bomb, that there's, going to be civilians killed and people are going to mind, and you could end up turning the population against you over time. Rather than saving the population, which is what they say they want to do. But this is just warfare. It's always the case that, especially in a guerrilla war, that you have these conundrums. And I am afraid that the more visible, active, kinetic the U.S. military is in the Pashtun areas of the southern part of the country, the more danger there is that they'll provoke a push to nationalism against them. At the moment, I would suspect that a majority of the Pashtuns are supporting Karzai, but I don't know how long that will be.
Well, and, you know, speaking of which, you said earlier he barely controls the country, barely ever has, and so, I don't know. I guess in Gareth Porter's recent reporting, he was saying they're trying to figure out how to call this a victory so that they can begin to leave. But how do they call it a victory if the government that they've created can't be the government of that country? And everybody knows it.
Well, the question is, you know, with Afghanistan, is if you ever have really a government. Maybe our expectations are too high. If Karzai or whoever succeeds Karzai can't control the country directly, you know, the real question is, can he get people on his side, more or less, who are out in the provinces, the warlords, can he bribe them or cajole them or threaten them into more or less not opposing him too strongly and doing what he wants? And that's the way a place like Afghanistan is ruled. You know, if somebody out in the provinces starts making trouble for Karzai, he finds out who that guy's rival is and gives them money to oppose him. And it makes for feuds, it makes for insecurity, and it's not the kind of government that Westerners would want to see. But, Afghanistan is just not going to be Sweden. And I got somebody shouted at me one time from the USAID that they're not trying to make it Sweden, they're trying to make it Bangladesh. And my question is whether they're going to succeed in that either.
What a great project. I wonder how many people involved in this took like a social or a sociology class in school. That was their project, to turn Afghanistan into Bangladesh. And,
Well, I think in the sense that Bangladesh, you know, inherited from the British rule, a functioning bureaucracy, and it does have an army, and it does seem to more or less control the place, but it's a light control.
Yeah. All right, now, so to the Iran part, because this is a major narrative always from at least certain segments of the war party beating the drum against Iran, blaming all of our problems, whether it's Iraq or anything else, really, nuclear weapons threats and so forth. It's always Iran, 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 and part of that is Iran's bad guys, Taliban's bad guys. Iran is probably arming the Taliban and screwing everything up for us, otherwise it'd be going great over there, right?
Yeah, you keep seeing these occasional reports coming out of the Pentagon that they think Iran is supporting Taliban factions and so forth. I just find it completely implausible, that Ali Khamenei and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, these hardline Shiites, sat down in a room and said, hey, let's give money to the hyper-Sunni Pashtuns who kill Shiites and make trouble for the Americans that way. I mean, they're going to kill the allies of Khamenei, who are the Hazara Shiites in Afghanistan. I'm not sure the Pentagon knows about the Hazara. But anyway, it doesn't make any sense to me. So then the WikiLeaks cables came out, and I saw one from last February where Secretary of Defense Robert M. Gates was meeting with his Italian counterpart, and Gates told his Italian counterpart that there's very little in the way of lethal material coming across the border from Iran into Afghanistan. And the charge had been from the Pentagon. Stanley McChrystal had said this, that deadly weapons are being supplied to the Taliban by Iran. So in private, Gates is completely contradicting this cover story. And we all know that to the extent that the Taliban are getting lethal material, it's coming from Pakistan, it's not coming from Iran. So I think it's just an outright lie. It's a warmongering against Iran. It's pulling the wool over the American people's eyes, and it's just completely an unrealistic assertion. And there you have it in the private cables that Gates was contradicting it.
Yeah. Well, it's the exact same scam they pulled off in 2006, 7, and 8 there. Well, especially, I guess, 7 and 8 in Iraq, blaming every roadside bomb on Iranian smuggling or what have you. But, you know, your number one myth here is, you know, also an outright lie. The biggest outright lie in the whole world, the most cynical lie that Barack Obama and his government could tell the American people, that the U.S. is in Afghanistan because otherwise it'll be a base for al-Qaeda to strike us and kill us.
No al-Qaeda to speak of in Afghanistan.
Simple as that. All right, everybody. That's Juan Cole. Informed comment. JuanCole.com. Author of Engaging the Muslim World, professor of history at the University of Michigan. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.